When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours. Like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute Productions, Patreon-exclusive podcast, The Decade Project, where we go back exactly a decade ago to the films that are still resonating, still kicking around, stuff that is still relevant or were really dynamic when they came out. And I've been going through the Rolodex of my incredible friendship group and people who've been part of the One Heat Minute journey. And this man absolutely has been a part of it. He's one of my dearest friends on this online world. I love him to pieces. He's an extremely talented author of Fierce Bitches. He's also a great researcher, a noir chronicler, and he's a person that genuinely, I don't know anyone pound for pound who watches more movies than him. I think he and Walter Chaw, like if they actually had a letterbox that was purely reflective of what they watched, they might get kicked off the app for scaring people away for an ability to consume cinema. So he's always one of my favorite people to talk to because like he's seen everything and his recall is unbelievable. But we've gone back to 2013 with my guest, Jedediah Ayres. Hello, Jed.
Hey.
And we're
good
going
to see you.
Great to see you. And we're going back to Danny Boyle's 2013 film, Trance.
5% of the population can be described as extremely suggestible.
What can you make them do?
Anything. Simon, close your eyes. I want you to follow my voice.
I like your voice.
Imagine you're in a place where you feel secure, in control, and you feel so comfortable, so relaxed. All your problems.
Where is
the painting? I don't remember.
Seems so far away and so long ago.
I remember that day.
What we are is the sum of everything we've ever done, which is constantly being revised and remembered.
I know what you were going to do to me.
She put that memory there. It's not real.
The plan was simple. Hypnotize the guy, you bring me back the painting.
Was I hypnotized?
He's afraid that once he's remembered, you'll kill him.
Now, right from the top, if memory serves me, it was about March in Australia, this psychological thriller that was originally by a guy named Joe Ahern, who made it into a TV show and then readapted by frequent Boyle collaborator John Hodge and turned into a movie in 2013, which he was doing around the time of his stint making stuff for the 2012 Olympics. It came out in Australia in March. And I remember seeing it in the theater here and watching it and going, this is the best movie of the year. And this is the standard that I'm going to be looking to. And obviously there are so many other films that I would think, I think maybe in a year that has like Her and Wolf of Wall Street and some others, it might not be my, it might not have eclipsed like the best movie of the year territory, but I was one of those guys that was firmly on this movie's wonderful and weird ride. A mind heist movie like Inception, a kind of Soderbergh-ian heist in the framing, an amnesia heist, all those things that I think if you just put a checkbox of Jed and I's personality, these are the things that get our dopamine going. It's trashy. It has Vincent Cassel. It's got it all. So Jed, tell me about like back then, if you remember seeing Danny Boyle's Trance, like how you saw it. Did you see it in the cinema? Did you catch it on home video? Like how did it all happen?
Yeah, I was aware of it. I was excited for it because the first marketing I saw, the trailer said from the director of Shallow Grave. I was like, oh, fuck yeah. We're getting Danny Boyle back to, you know, this nasty, you know, dark crime shit that, you know, I like Slumdog Millionaire and it's fine. I've had no interest really in rewatching that one or 127 hours or so, even though I admire that he can make something, you know, that beautiful out of those premises. It was like, no, I you know, for as many movies as I watch, and I watch a lot of movies, my focus is always crime. It's my favorite thing, and so I want all my favorite filmmakers making crime movies. And yeah, so I was very excited that this was being advertised as from the maker of Shallow Grave.
Yes.
So I thought, oh, this is going to be it. I did not see it in theaters. I had two young children, as you know, what that's like.
It takes you from 20 to 30 movies a year in the cinema as an average to four, like almost overnight, forgetting about the addition of, you know, one and two and three jobs in there. It does slightly slow you down, but that's what the home video is built for.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny since Letterboxd, and I'm so bad at technology. I'm just figuring out, as Blake can attest, I'm sitting here talking on one device that's got audio and another device that's got video because I can't figure out how to make one do both. But I'm very bad at technology. I'm just figuring out how to use Letterboxd to do the diary thing so I can like keep track of when I watch movies and things like that, not just that I've seen a movie. And I look back now on, all right, how many movies did I see theatrically this year? And like before I was married, it was, you know, it was probably, it was around 60 or 70 movies a year. And then it was, when I got married, it was slightly less than that. And when I had kids, it just like, fell off
the graph.
Like yeah. Fewer than 10 a year, you know, and now that they're older, that's definitely picking back up. But
you the know, boys are last the boys are now pushing you. That's what's fun when we talk. The boys are like, Dad, we're going to see X. That's fun. That's 10 out of 10. When you get that, you're like, all right, I'm in.
That is fun. My son's coming back from he's been out of the country for several weeks, and he texted me last night right before he's getting on a plane to come home, and he said, are we doing Barbenheimer? I don't know that I've got that in me, but I can probably do one of them with you.
You've got the stamina these days for a Barbenheimer.
Stamina, it's opportunity. I mean, my schedule's all wonky. I'm up all night and tend to sleep all day, and they don't show movies throughout the night. But anyway, I was excited to see Trance, but I did not catch it theatrically. When I did catch it, honestly, I was kind of let down. I mean, not big let down, but I thought, oh, this is a fun movie. It's obviously amazing to look at. It is just gorgeous. And so, you know, it just goes down so easy. But I, you know, I felt it was pretty silly in the end. It was silly. Yeah. And, you know, I thought, okay, well, it wasn't what I was really hoping it was going to be, but it was all right. It was okay. And then a few years later, I revisited it. I was like, no, there's more there than I was giving it credit for. And just slowly over the years, it's become my most rewatched Danny Boyle movie. It might be my favorite Danny Boyle movie at this point. And it's the pleasures of it really, I think, really reveal themselves in multiple rewatches, which is, you know, a legitimate criticism for it, I suppose, to say, you know, I didn't care for it the first time and why would I go back to it? But, you know, if there's something kind of tickling at the back of your brain, you're like, I want to revisit that one, I think you'll find it to be very rewarding. And I've watched it, you know, probably 4 or 5 times in the last couple of months, just kind of getting ready to talk to you. And even this morning I watched it again and it was like, oh man, I really see this part of it very clearly now and for the first time. I think it's a great flick.
Oh, that's so good to hear that you talk about the rewatchability, because like I remember 2013, because I saw it in the cinema, I was like so blown away. It was a Aussie media screening. So then I think I went for a second time in the theater, really enjoyed it. And then it came out on Blu-ray and I've got one of those. This is a beautiful thing about physical media. I think this is the peak time for Blu-ray around this time, is because they just started putting trailers like we used to get on VHSs, like at the beginning of a Blu-ray before it even let you get to a menu. So it was like this morning I'm on there and like the trailer for Chan Wook's film Stoker came on. And I was like, ooh, you know, what a time to be alive when we had physical media with trailers. And I watched it a fair few times, but I hadn't before we had started talking about it again. And when I watched it, like you said, the effortlessness of a Danny Boyle joint when it starts, music, pacing, tone, mouth-watering shots, these beautiful, after this quick editing that's super purposeful, this ability, especially for the whole premise of the movie, to have these kind of glacial, contemplative, kind of like weird and haunting, like tracks on the camera at places or images or locations that you're not quite sure what their significance are. And obviously it's going to later to be revealed. I was just like, oh my God, Danny Boyle can shoot the living daylights out of a scene that other people would just be so bored with or so timid. And he's just so bold in every choice that you're like, oh, I love every scintilla of this. And that opening to get to the heist before we finally find Simon, so James McAvoy's character, before we finally find Simon, you know, and start digging into the fact that he had a relationship with Vincent Gonzalez Frank and the crew of thieves, and before we meet Rosario Dawson's
spoiler alert.
Spoilers. I think everyone knows at this point we're going to spoil it. It's 10 years old. But before all of that, there's just these delicate touches and a couple of moments, and he uses James McAvoy's face to great effect, and he's kind of like, I don't know, like, a lot going on behind the eyes, just really terrific. And I just, man, it just, even if you thought it was silly or even if you thought it was like trashy, I'm like, pound for pound, the filmmaking is, it's peerless. It's like he's such a master of his craft and I love his style. And he's like one of the only ones, you know, one of the only guys who can do it. It's more like I was trying to like get an allegory for it, but it's more like it's slightly more controlled chaos of like peak Oliver Stone. Like Oliver Stone's more like intentionally disorientating, but Danny Boyle's like, he uses it to displace you and maybe take you off the scent of whatever the movie is doing. But man, the filmmaking is just, for me, this was Boyle getting back to genre, like in a big bad way. And you know, Slumdog was such a behemoth, but it was like, when I look back, I'm like, obviously Trainspotting, and maybe because Australia is, you know, part of the Commonwealth, like Trainspotting was like one of the biggest movies ever here. One of the biggest movies of several decades, like, you know, sort of industry defining. But like 28 Days Later, love. Sunshine, adore. And so this was me getting back like, yeah, give him like a dopey genre premise and just see what he does, because there's kind of nobody like him. And I love that about him.
Yeah, Oliver Stone's a good callback. I watched last year, I watched all of the Oliver Stone films, and it was amazing just to think, man, this used to be, you know, this was tentpole summer blockbuster material. You know, I saw Natural Born Killers several times theatrically in packed houses. I was like, this is nuts, absolutely crazy. But this is, this was just what people went to see on a Saturday night, you know, took their dates to and things like that. So
yeah,
Oliver Stone, obviously JFK. Tony Scott.
JFK, JFK was ginormous. Like, it was just as I was becoming really aware of movies and going to the movies. And like, I even remember being in a like Gosford Village twin about, in a cinema that no longer exists. It probably hasn't existed for 20 years. And I remember being like 6 or 7, that's where we would see some of the big movies. And like, I still remember, because we went to Terminator and I think we were going to another kid's movie in like 93 or whatever. But when JFK came out, like, there were huge JFK posters and the parents left you with babysitters or not, because it was the early 90s, late 80s. So they didn't give a shit. They just went out. But they went out to see JFK. And so, yeah, like this, I love this kind of like.
The Doors.
And, yeah. I mean, yes.
Just so wild, good. Wild shit. But, you know, people like Stone, like Tony Scott, like even Soderbergh to a degree is, you know, such like their stamp is in the editing often, you know.
Yes.
It's not just, and I really think as a writer of fiction, of prose, and I've adapted a couple of books for the screen, you know, nothing that's been seen, thank God, but you know, the trickiness of it, of those adaptations often is, you know, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. Well, these guys layer picture on top of picture on top of picture. And it's, you know, to get this sort of density, this sort of subliminal, subconscious density of what goes into, you know, when you read a book, all that, you know, all the psychology, all the things like that. I think they're really doing something like that with these layering of images, with the repetitions of beats. And of course, this film dealing with hypnosis is full of these audio and visual cues and these sort of pulses that you know are, you know, it's like somebody who knows very just enough about movies to have opinions. probably this movie is
wait that's right
again.
I'm just gonna say that's radical of you to say that you know just enough, isn't it? That's a nice level of humility maybe for our generation. It's like, oh, like I feel like now, late, you know, late 30s, you know, I'm like, I think I kind of now actually maybe know a little bit what I'm talking about. Whereas it's like, that's not something that people qualify on the internet very much, Jed. So I just wanted to flag it in case people are shocked.
Well, I should let you just go with thinking I'm being humble here, but I was actually not talking about myself. I was just talking about people who are just kind of, they are understanding, they're interested in film or literature or something like that. And they get into, they see something like this and there's just so much information and there's so kind of, I guess you could say obvious about, you know, if like they can pick up on things.
Yes.
Say, oh, they're doing this, they're doing that. They tend to just fucking hate that movie. They're like, oh, I could see everything that's going on. And I mean, first of all, no, you can't. But no, you can see some things. And you know, this sort of you know, the kind of comedy films we get where, you know, like Scary Movie or Airplane, where they, or Walk Hard, where, you know, the comedy is just, hey, I've seen a bunch of movies and I recognize these tropes, these yes. things that just keep happening. And so I'm just going to compile that and make jokes out of all of it. You know, that's the kind of the criticism I think this movie drives people crazy who are just kind of becoming aware of what films do.
Yes.
of how they're manipulative and things like that. So,
and yet where I'm at, I'm like, manipulate me. Yep. You know, I'm like, manipulate, be as long, especially when you're talking about like, so much about great films in the weird, you know, sorry to sound like pretentious or whatever, but you know, a lot of people use the word alchemy, but I just truly think it is a pairing of filmmaking collaborators, whether that's actors, writers, directors, editors, cinematographers, set designers, costume, everything, all this great collaboration, usually guided by a very clear and deliberate authorial voice, meeting with material that they have a very unique point of view on. And particularly this material of like a heist that takes place, a degenerate gam, like a guy who seems like a sweetie pie that's kind of getting dragged into, you know, so there's so many great stories about that, like a sweetie pie who gets involved on with the wrong crew of criminals, gets manipulated to do something and then messes it up and there are consequences. Like that's a very familiar trait, but it's like that then layered with the fact that he's not a nice guy, he's actually kind of an awful piece of shit, like when you start digging through the layers of his psyche. And then layers of like hypnosis and like sleeper agents and sleeper, you know, you start to get to more of the paranoia cinema of the kind of Cold War. And it all layers into this beautiful thing of like sleeper agents, and this and that, and some of these things. And it's like the theme fits most perfectly with the style. Like, and so then you have this, and I even think about it with Trainspotting 2, which might be my favorite Boyle film, is that it feels like a collage. Like a sonic and visual collage of fleeting memories that you're piecing together with aging photographs and aging people. And I'm like, style fits that with the theme. And he has that great, so many of his films have a marriage of that innate awareness of like style, theme, style, theme, style, theme. And the pairing is so perfect. And this, it's like, it takes what is ultimately pretty trashy, but gloriously trashy, and elevates it to this beautiful, like just as a formal work, like his tools are on show and you go, tell me who else could have made this out of that. Yeah. Like you know, he meets the material at such a level that you're like, whoa, you must pay attention. And that's what I love about Danny Boyle.
Yeah. It's pretty wonderful. Wonderful that way. And if, completely forgot what I was just gonna
well let's
just gonna say
so let's maybe do this, because at the time, largely received well film, got a kind of it had a 61% on like a, you know, a Metacritic. I know that some people will talk about Rotten Tomatoes and stuff like that, but like Metacritic at the time, Metacritic is a lot of the best, very, very, very best critics in the world. And if you want to kind of like, Rotten Tomatoes is a much broader spectrum of critics from all over the world. So sometimes the kind of yay, nay, or thumbs up, thumbs down approach that tomato score does, especially when you're looking at critics, is just kind of saying, are people broadly positive or are people broadly negative on it? But the 61% as a rating and a score that's on Metacritic is sometimes pretty indicative of some of those high level critics. At the time, 61%, which is not bad, like, you know, really insanely high scoring movies on Metacritic only get like into the 80s. So it's kind of like a, you know, a 4 out of 5 or a 3 out of 4, however you want to sort of talk about it. And got some really big reviews at the time. And since then, just because, I don't know if it's the same in the States, and I know you're a physical media head, so we will never have this issue, but you can't find this fucking movie on streaming services. I don't know what's going on. You cannot find it. It's not anywhere I've been able to find. And I'm like, so bizarre. It feels like that transition between VHS and DVD all over again, where it's like, is this ever coming to DVD? Are we ever going to get this? And that's why I think I love things like Imprint Films and those places, because they find these gems that were such staples of previous eras of physical media, and they bring them back to life and, you know, reanimate the corpses. And yeah, this, you know, it's so nice to now come back 10 years later. And I feel like up until recently, even the guys who were doing the Blank Check podcast covering Danny Boyle, I feel like this was the one where people were like, it was so like these late, a few of these later Boyles just so dismissed or like not really into it. Whereas I think, like you're saying, I think it's aging better.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's quite good. Like, it's quite good. And I gotta say, I think that you are very good at something that I am not, which is taking these sort of flawless films. You can really pick out some gems that, to me, I feel like I need something a little rough, a little jagged, a little to really snare my attention. And maybe it's because I just watch so many movies, but like, you know, Zodiac, you know, a movie that we talked about.
Yeah.
You know, I remember liking it fine. But when I went back to watch it, because I knew you were covering it, you know, it really kind of opened up for me. And I was like, no, there's something that I did not, you know, it was too perfect, too beautiful, too smooth. And I feel like this is also something that way, where I tend to like Filth came out the same year.
Great movie too. I had a fun time with Filth. This was actually McAvoy. I think Filth, this is something we're going to get to later, but I think Filth might be the best McAvoy. Like maybe the best.
It's my favorite.
Yeah.
It's my favorite performance of it. It's the movie that made a McAvoy fan out of me. I really didn't have, like, people were McAvoy fans, and you know, I just didn't understand what the appeal. I mean, I thought he was fine and not like him or anything, but there was nothing about him that really, you know, grabbed my attention. But I saw Filth, and that absolutely, you know, rocked me. I don't remember which one I saw first, but Filth really blew my hair back. And I thought, you know, this guy is, you know, he can go there. He can get something like that. So, you know, but that's a grody, pretty rancid piece of, that's got a lot of style. You know, it does a lot of these montages and things like that, that your Boyles and your Finchers and your, you know, Stones and Scotts, and that, you know, it gets a lot of mileage out of some really great montages, but these are not going down easy, right? These are really jagged, you know, probably septic little shards that you're sagging up. And those, you know, that really kind of snagged me.
I tell you what, if I ever own a theater, I'm flying you out, and your particular programming run at that theater that you'll introduce and curate is going to be called Septic. It has to be called Septic, the Jet Air Septic Cinema. You have to. It's Septic, and then Sin, S-I-N Cinema. That's exactly that's the perfect encapsulation of what Filth is. Because I remember seeing it and being like, this is disgusting, but man, I can't look away from this guy. The combination of all those things, even though it was a bit grubby, even though it wasn't, you know, completely perfect. You know, I credit you a lot, as many times as I can, with this great outlook on movies, which is like, and I've said it to you before, which is like, you tweeted once. So funny to say you tweeted, right? Like this is where you did your TED talk or something, but it was a TED talk in a tweet, which is like, huh, you guys really have to like a whole movie?
And the whole movie has to be good.
The whole movie has to be good. I love that. That's the way I've reframed it in my head. It's like, oh, you really like to like a whole movie? Like, And I'm like, yeah, exactly. Like whatever it is resonating with you, that can hit you on a like really high frequency. And if other parts of the movie don't work for you, especially if you really drive with one bit, a lot of shit just melts away. You're like, yeah, I'm fine. Like, yes, I may know that it's imperfect, whatever, but you know, I'm not going to argue with you. I'm just going to tell you that it, I like it. And so, yeah, I think that Filth is like that. But for me, when I come back to trance, some of the things that Filth doesn't quite hit same frequency on, despite McAvoy's amazing performance, the style and the filmmaking of trance, like, oh, it just, that fusion of style, that's just it. But yeah, it was funny. McAvoy was like that thing that people were trying to make happen a lot. And at this time of his career, you know, he's in these movies, he's in the X-Men's, he's sort of getting gigantic from a Hollywood perspective. And I'm finding him so much more interesting when he like pops up in random things like Atomic Blonde. Like I'm like when he just turned, it's like full Dirtbag McAvoy. Like when Dirtbag McAvoy is around, I'm like, yeah, I'm in. Let's do this thing. Like that's what I want.
And I mean, that's what obviously Filth gave us and was advertised as. I think the, you know, the beauty of trance is that it's his dewy face that's introducing us and his, you know, and like it subverts everything that you assume about this movie. You know, that that he's the good guy, that Vincent Cassell is the psychopath, the violent guy, that Rosario Dawson is in, you know, trouble, that she's in over her head and this thing. And, you know, and it's a heist within a heist, you know, there's the stealing the painting and then there's the breaking into your mind to get it back. And everybody's part of it. I love those scenes, those trance scenes where like, he's in the within his mind, he's in that red car.
Yes.
And Rosario Dawson is in the car with him and the four thieves are outside the window trying to you know, they can see the painting in the lining of his jacket, right? And they're like, stop you know, he's wanting to focus on her and they're trying to get him back to, you know, look at the painting and you know, where is it? And they're hovering over him. You know what they're hovering? They're hovering over him the same way the witches in the painting are hovering over the guy.
Yeah.
You know, with the blanket pulled over his head. It's just like little touches like that that are so, I haven't read the script, but that's what Danny Boyle saw when he was, you know, putting this together. And it's so gorgeous, so multi-layered, and so just playful and fun. And I do think that it can come out, you can come out the other end of trance and not feel particularly emotionally moved, other than feeling kind of excited and a little giddy that, you know,
they pulled off the magic trick. Yeah.
Right. But I do think, like, the more I watch it, the more emotional response I have to the, especially the Vincent Cassell character.
Yes.
You know, that kind of shot of him at the very end, coming out of his swimming pool, and he just looks blank. Like, he looks completely emptied out, totally hollowed out. He's been through this ordeal. And, you know, and then he gets the messenger at the door with a delivery for him. But, I think, because you really have to watch the movie a couple of times to get the perspective of, you know, okay, who's, like, let's think about the story, the chronological story from this character's point of view. Let's think about it from that character's point of view. And thinking about it from his point of view is really starting to kind of make me emotional when I watch it now. I do feel for him a lot. And I feel excited by the moxie of Rosario Dawson's character. You know,
yes.
I feel like, oh, man.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
You know, I love that she orchestrates the whole thing for herself, you know, not to make something better or whatever, but she's been hurt. She's been made to feel scared and threatened. And she's like, you know what? You're going to do this for me.
Yeah.
Just because I can make you do this. I'm going to flex my power and make you do this, and I'm going to feel better about myself, not for money, not for what, you know, I'm just, this is what it takes for me to move on with my life, is to show, you know, prove to myself that I can, that I'm in control, that I can do this. And, you know, I can get behind that now in a way that, I, you know, took several viewings, to do. So not, On the first viewing, it is just a fun sort of giddy ride, and yeah, they pull off the magic trick. But with more and more watches, I am getting more emotionally involved in it, and that's a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, that's something you nailed for me with her is when you first watch it, it's like, oh, look at the magic trick. Next couple of watches, it might be like, oh God, look at the moxie. Like, look at the bravery. Look at the, you know, there's a few times where Simon is playing with chips. Even when he goes back into his house for the first time, he picks up casino chips. And I'm like, he's the casino chip. Like, she's laying him all, she's all in with this gambit, right? Like, she's using him as like a physical pawn in the game that he doesn't realize he's a part of because of how awful and cruel he's been. And then you're like, okay, cool. Yeah. Oh, look at the moxie. Yeah. And now I think it's like, you know, it's that Newton's law of like every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And so you have this, you know, it's AKA karma. Basically it feels like the karmic awfulness that he has exacted on her and others and himself is so bad. That's a question you ask is, you know, there's so many great movies do it with different relationships between characters is how bad must this character have treated that person to hate them so much or to be that vindictive? And I think that sometimes that's a really beautiful thing. And you know, it's a really beautiful and an interesting thing, obviously not beautiful because it's not nice, but it's like, man, pain has ramifications. And so that's something I love about this. It's like, ultimately you've got these people who are all playing their different game, but her game comes from pain. And then you start asking a question, as I agree with you, it's like, how bad was he to make her want to have this gambit to go, I'm going to use my powers for evil rather than good.
Yeah, and I like that you bring up that you brought up Newton, because I was thinking about that's his character's name is Simon Newton.
Yeah,
and I was Simon thinking Newton. About, you know, yep. Newton's laws of attraction, that you know, he is just absolutely gravitating toward her, and she realizes what she can do with that. And yeah, and then of course her name too is Elizabeth Lamb, you know, this innocence. Yeah. Innocence is a big part of the psychology of the film, the character. And it's one of those things that, again, the first time you see it, it's like, how fucking dopey can you get? This is, you know, this is really kind of almost insulting, right? But
you're right. You said something so perfect before, which is like there's a playful energy, and Boyle doing that car set piece that you're talking about that actually then mirrors Goya's Witches in the Air, where there's the four witches in the air and there's the guy with the blanket underneath. When he does that, that's almost like him going, he's like sort of leaping out of the screen to be the audience's psyche, like, get back to how the fuck this happened. Stop getting distracted with how beautiful Rosario Dawson is, even though obviously we can empathize, she is absolutely stunning. But it's like, let's get back to how he got the painting. What happened to the painting? It's right there. Like, tell us the story. And that's him kind of going like, wink, guys. Yeah, I know. Like, you see all these tricks that might've been annoying you. That's, I'm right here. I'm doing it. Like, everything here is an intentional thing to just pace this out exactly as you want. But that's the sense of play that I love in a Danny Boyle movie. Where I'm like, yeah, I'm in good hands. This is fine. Who cares? Like, I'm not in a rush. You're going to get to it when you need to. Like, it's all good. And I feel like some filmmakers, for whatever reason, and I can't explain it all the time, they just make you more comfortable with their, I don't know, with their stylistic acumen and the way that they structure a scene and or set you up for a story where you're like, I'll be patient. If I don't know what the hell's going on, but I'm having a really good time, that's fine with me. I'm good. I'm still completely engaged, and I want to watch.
Yeah, it's also, you know, one of those movies about movie making. And movies about movie making can be really irritating. And, you know, I really appreciate him making his film, his almost confessional film. If I'd never seen any interviews with him, period, I think. But I watched a couple of interviews with him when he was out promoting this. And he kept talking about how important it was for him that everything in the movie, from the hypothetical, the hypnotherapy, you know, it's all possible. Like,
yes,
you know, none of this was, you know, he kept stressing, yes, this can be done, you know, and then he would say, it's not ethical, but it can be done. It's not ethical, but this can be done. And, you know, and I was just so seeing him as a director saying that, well, that's my job is to, you know, I manipulate actors and I manipulate actors to manipulate audiences. And, you know, and I can absolutely do this. I have this power. I can do this. I can pull things out of actors. I can pull things. Now I have to wrestle some with what's ethical.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. What's ethical? What's abusive? What's, you know, how ruthless am I in pursuing, a goal? But it's all possible.
It's all possible.
I can absolutely, you know, there's a certain segment of the population who I can direct, you know, who are very susceptible to my manipulate, you know, and if they give themselves to me and open up, you know, I can really pull some amazing stuff out of them. And and they in turn can then influence the audience. It's almost like he's saying, he's Rosario Dawson, the actors are James McAvoy, and the audience is the Band of Thieves, you know.
Yes.
He can direct someone to have an influence on a wider mass, and he can really, and you know, he didn't have to come out and say that. He never said that in the interviews, but it seemed patently obvious to me that was his drive here. Is he's making a film about filmmaking, and I appreciate him dressing it up in a crime thriller.
And always more attractive when you dress any idea up as a sexy crime thriller. And I think that you just said, like, what kind of movies do you like? You know, anything dressed as a sexy crime thriller. I don't care what it is. Could be a socio-political commentary. Could be a movie about filmmaking. Could be a movie about desire. Could be a horror. Could be a, you know, about the darkest, you know, nooks and crannies of the human experience. But you dress it up as a sexy crime thriller, I'm in. Like, it's just kind of like, it's like, that's it. That's enough. I'm not a very complicated person in that regard.
You know, and that, I mean, I think Possessor, Brandon Cronenberg's Possessor, yes, is the same thing.
Yeah,
you know,
terrific,
that's a film about filmmaking.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the character losing their identity by trying to assume, you know, trying to really portray someone else, and the Jennifer Jason Leigh is kind of like the director figure in that one. And I think Guillermo del Toro's remake of Nightmare Alley is similar. You know, God, what a candy colored, you know, super easy going down visual feast that is. You know, I love that kind of stuff. Trance.
Now that's a good double feature, Jed.
Yeah.
Because what one of the things that I would say is when we go through the Decade Project, you know, we've been talking a lot about the preliminary reception. We're talking about Boyle talking about it. We've then talked about like how it's aged because we're looking back through and we're kind of mining and doing the thing that, you know, you do a lot and do so beautifully, is like you're always so insanely prepared and researched on different things that we talk about. But I love that that's what you're talking about. It's like now this kind of movie, this kind of curio where it's like playing with these kind of themes and this psychological thing and manipulation and, you know, especially unethical manipulation, they do pop up again in the form of like a Nightmare Alley, which is unashamedly a genre film first. And then secondly, this kind of like, hypnotic manipulating kind of movie where there are forces that are, you know, going for what the protagonist ultimately wants, and they think they're in way more control than they are. And they do pop up, and like that was nearly 10 years later that Nightmare Alley pops up, and it pops up again, and that's a nominated for an Oscar. It's not quite as we don't get to see some of the ladies in their full completely Brazilian glory, and so it maybe isn't not necessarily as considered to be as trashy, and it maybe like cuts through and becomes more that, but like that's the kind of like that's a very noir thing of like these forces that when you're thinking that you're in total control that are all, you know, cannibalizing you and being like vultures, like picking the meat from your bones without sometimes you even knowing that it's happening. And I think this is it's really particularly special in that regard. It's funny that, you know, a Trance Nightmare Alley rewatch is you maybe convinced me to do a double feature one night when the kids go to bed early. That might be a good one.
Well, I thought Nightmare Alley, not to get too digressive here, but was a really interesting choice. You know, his previous film being nominated for an Oscar, you know, that he was this horror filmmaker. You know, he made monster movies, you know, and then he wins an Oscar for Shape of Water. And then his next film is about a carny who has delusions of, you know, whose downfall is he wants to be respected. You know, yes, he wants to get into high society. He's really successful, grubby little entertainer, but, you know, he loses his soul when he goes for the brass ring, the high society stuff. So I thought, oh, that's a really interesting choice to follow up Shape of Water with. But I digress, and you can cut that out.
No. I like this. Is the show, it lives for its digressions. Favorite what ifs? I love Vincent Cancella's Frank. Also a hilarious name, Frank. You know, he's pretty frank and he's pretty candid and honest. He's like the kind of like reorienting like person who's experiencing reality in a way that we completely understand. But in May 2011, Michael Fassbender was actually cast as Frank. So it was going to be a reconnection of these two guys from another thing before he eventually dropped out. And then Colin Firth, strangely enough, who I think is wonderful in grubby movies too. He's a guy who weirdly straddles, speaking of being a carny and then going into high society, he's a guy who can go all the way down to the dirt, but and I kind of enjoy when he does take a digression to the dirt, but then he's so spectacular when he does that sort of high society thing. And then the other three main actors, according to this, that were considered were for the Rosario Dawson role was Scarlett Johansson, Melanie Thierry, and Zoe Saldana were all considered eventually. For Dawson, who at the time I believe was actually dating Danny Boyle. It becomes an even more interesting thing when he uses her as like the architect of all of this manipulation, because he's got the same level of infatuation with her as Simon. So it's like he is Simon, yeah. and he is Simon, and he's Lamb as well. I think it's, you know, really incredible that he was kind of like, did all the principal filming, went off and did the summer Olympics opening ceremony direction and organized all that, and then like went back to the drawing board with everything that had already shot and like assembled this movie, and we get Trance. You know, that's I love a couple of those sliding doors, particularly the Fassbender one, because I love Vincent Cassel, and I would never have put those two together, but I'm like, actually Vincent Cassel and Michael Fassbender probably have a lot in common as far as like the roles that they're the very best at. They're both great at playing awful people who are really engaging, but they're also like both really attractive and alluring guys and can play like suave and charm, but it's a dark charm. So yeah, I liked that. And you know, if you liked the those X-Men First Class kind of times, those guys have had a bit of an undeniable chemistry. So I think it might have had a nice little fun wrinkle had they been in the same movie together outside of a Marvel movie, you know?
That's funny. If you told me Fassbender was originally going to be cast, I would have assumed playing the McAvoy role.
Yes.
No, I think he's good, and he could absolutely do the Frank role. But Vincent Cassel, I think, is a stronger choice for that role just because of his body of work, just because yes. of, you know, not necessarily his capabilities compared to Fassbender's, but like I said, everything in this film is inverted from your expectations. And you see these three on a poster, you can pick out, you know, the innocent and the criminal gangster threatening type, and they're all of course turned inside out. But I also like him, Cassel, in the role, because you know, that shot of him coming out of the pool I talked about, where he just looks kind of empty, hollowed out. His eyes are like, he's got the pool water on him, but it also looks like he's crying. You know, it's just like this, he's completely empty. And I like to think that it's the same character from Ocean's 12, who is this hotshot thief, right? And he was full of himself. And it was his downfall, you know.
Always his downfall.
Completely shown up by Danny Ocean and his team, and he's just, you know, he's spent the last several years just kind of not quite hitting rock bottom, but like just getting down to the, you know, a lower, much lower rung, and when. You see, he's just kind of this grubby criminal now. I like to think it's the same character. You know, he's gone through this sort of rock, and this is the heist that kind of gets his Frank got his groove back, and they're both named Frank.
Yes.
Ocean's 12 is Francois, you know. But this one's Frank with that fucking weird spelling.
F-R-A. I know. It's not like K could be strong enough. They have to put right. CK together. It's like they're making this prunk. They're making the same sound. I don't know why we need these extra letters. I want to talk to you about the music in this a little bit because it's so special. Rick Smith, who's from the band Underworld, composed the music, and they've been working together, you know, obviously since Trainspotting. Underworld has such a iconic place in cinema history because of its use, because of the way that Danny Boyle deploys it in Trainspotting. But I do love that he kind of has let, because it is ultimately this trinity, this triangle of like people that are at the center of this thing. But I just love that Boyle and like John Hodge, and then he's got like Rick Smith who doing the music, and it feels like a cohesive album. Like I don't know about you, but I love listening to an album that feels like it has a story. And I don't mean necessarily like a ballad, a whole bunch of interconnecting stuff, but like something that feels like a cohesive, it's doing something, it's stretching, it's trying to tell a story. And I love that the soundtrack, it's kind of not wedded to any rules. It's just like these feet. It's like you can feel more of like a pure musician. That's not as, you know, when you were talking about Jagged, it's not as sharp in the visual manipulation and the character manipulation, because that's Boyle being sharp. It's this kind of amorphous thing that just flows with the tone of the movie and is, it picks up its tempo in the high tempo, and then in the slow stuff it's happy to just go with the pace of the visuals. And there's something weird about that, because it's not like, it's not overpowering you in any way, it's just doing this beautiful complementary thing always in tone, in time, in like that metronomic structure of the movie. It's kind of like it changes its pace based on the pace of the editing, and I really undervalued it, like, and I think it's really special. I think that Rick Smith was kind of like doing some of the stuff that we now like shout the praises of people like Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor for doing, because it's like that ability to really be aligned with the editorial pace of the movie. Like, you know, one of those like Chuck Jones, animations in the 50s of like how he animates to the music perfectly, and the music is perfectly fused to the pacing of that. It's like, it's almost that level of, I don't know, science of how to have a score that complements what you're seeing on the screen.
It's I did not realize, in fact, when I hear his score there, I just think, oh, that's Danny Boyle music. It's Danny Boyle. It's just the sound I associate with Danny Boyle films. And it's not something that I would usually just like put on to listen to myself, but it absolutely fits. I wouldn't want anything else in its place in here. And I'll confess, one of the things about this film that is so complex is parsing, and it's not really important to do that in the end, but it is a difficult thing to do sometimes, is parse when you're in a trance and when something's actually physically happening.
Yes, yes.
And there's the scene, the big nude scene, the big reveal is scored so heavily, so this pulsing song that I don't know if it's, the only place I know this song from is the film.
Yes.
But it's, you know, I can hear it in my head as I'm talking about it now. It's very strong. For some reason that scene made a big impression on me.
It was definitely the music.
But the song, it cuts from her walking out, and you see her reflection in the floor, and then it just like drips upward into the reality of her standing in front of him. And he's so mesmerized by her. And then the next thing that you see is him walking out of her building in the morning.
Yes.
Loosey-goosey. Happy, confident, and Frank is waiting for him outside in his little minivan, and he's listening to the song on the radio.
Yes.
And when he gets out of his car and he shuts the door, the sound goes, the song goes away. And then when they get into his vehicle and go back to his place, the song is still playing in the car. So like,
yeah.
And that whole sequence that follows, like that whole thing is the trance. And it took me, I don't know how many times watching it to understand. Oh, I mean, obviously by the time the sequence gets to the point where McAvoy's blown half of his head away and he's still talking to him, you realize this is not physical reality. But, you know, trying to trace back, when did it become a trance? Well, it became a trance as soon as she hypnotized him with the, you know, her body. And then we cut back to, you know, that's the real heist is happening right then. She's stealing.
Yeah, she's stealing
the painting from him. She's completely disarmed him, and they didn't even have sex, right? It cuts back to him sitting there completely naked on the bed, holding his cock in his hands. And he suddenly wakes up, you know, and I love that he's sitting there on the bed holding his dick, and in the trance, when you realize, okay, everything that came before is the trance, she is guiding him as in the trance, he's talking to her on his phone, and as he believes these guys are about to kill him, and she takes him to get a gun, you know.
Yes.
Here's the gun. You get the gun, and he's walking. The imagery, there's no other way to say it. The imagery is extremely vaginal.
Yes.
As he is descending down this pink hallway. He's just going into this pink hallway and just being enveloped inside it. And he's got this gun in his hand and his smile on his face, like he feels powerful. And, you know, he goes and it's beautiful, but I just love him waking up there holding his dick. And he didn't even get laid, you know.
Nope. Not at the end of it.
Didn't even get laid.
The fantasy was too overwhelming and too strong, and he's still there with his dick in his hand. Look, I don't know if we're going to top extremely vaginal. So I'm going to say thank you so much for coming back to talk to me about Danny Boyle's Trance. I love talking to you about movies like this, because I think you said it earlier, and I wanted to say that until we were closing out, that like there is just something about the reward of a movie is so worthwhile if it does exactly what you said, which is if it just scratches and grates. It's almost like a cupboard door that doesn't quite fit, or, you know, like a tag in a shirt that itches or something. There's just something, if a movie penetrates enough that like it starts messing around with you and you start remembering scenes and maybe you didn't like it, that is like, that's, you can't create it. It just happens. But when it happens, you're like, oh shit, like there's something there. I love that feeling. And I think that Trance is exactly that movie. Like I jive with it immediately, because I was just, again, even at that time in 2013, there's a lot of good movies in 2013, but even at that time, I was just like, oh my God, it's so nice to be in Danny Boyle's hands again in a crime thriller with all of his tools on show. And it's not maybe a story that doesn't necessarily resonate with me as much, but it's just like so unbelievable. Bang, 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 bang. Like just great. But I think that that's all of Danny Boyle's movies. It's been so rare. There's maybe one in his entire filmography where I was like, ugh, I don't ever want to see that again. But they always have an itch. There's always something where you're like, there's that little scratch. There's that little, you know, little bit of thread catches it through a door. There's something there that like gets you. And this movie, for all of his tricks, and when you see all of his tricks on show, unlike seeing the magic trick where you're like, I don't care anymore. It's like, no, actually, I love his magic. I kind of want him to keep fooling me again and again. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's just, for the love of God, please make it something that's not yesterday, because that hurt so much, Danny. It really, really, that was I mixing the Beatles and Danny Boyle, two of my favorite things together, and not landing, that hurts. So, you know, This is definitely one of my favorites. So thank you so much for coming and talking to me about it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, off air, I'll talk to you more about the other vaginal imagery in the film. It's very captivating.
Thank you.
I'm not,
man,
talking about that scene.
No. There's more. I know some of the things you're talking about. All right, man. Well, take care, and we'll talk to you again soon.
And it feels like such a 20th century movie. It feels like something David Lean would have done or tried to do when he still had that kind of currency. And even then, he might not have succeeded.
It's incredible because, like, if you don't have time to watch all five seasons of Lost, you can just watch Fearless.
Not a week goes by that I don't think of the ending of Gallipoli. It's left a mark. A Year of Living Dangerously. And then something like Last Wave, even, that's so deeply embedded with the land and the story of the land, the story of place. You know, I don't know that I'd seen very many movies at that point in my life that had such a down ending, and they had such a, you know, sort of strong sense of folklore attached to it as that. And something always so poetic and lyrical about Peter Weir's work.
Gallipoli was the first movie that ever traumatized me, and I don't think I ever really recovered from it. And I'm still upset that they played it in school. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to make an... They say it's not possible to make an anti-war movie, but I think Peter Weir pulled it off.
Yes.
Because no one watches that movie then thinks, I want to go to war.
Peter Weir is the greatest director that Australia has ever produced. Like, bar none, hands down. Like, no one else is even in the room.
I think you have covered some really titanic filmmakers and some really titanic films so far, but I truly think what makes Peter Weir special and what makes you doing this one special is we don't talk about Peter Weir that way, and we should. Peter Weir is one of those guys who I don't get why he isn't a bigger name, why he isn't more in that rarefied air.
Yes.
Because I think film for film, he's one of our very best filmmakers. He has brought his A game repeatedly to many properties. There are films of his that I hold very dear. Fearless, The Mosquito Coast. I will fight somebody if they talk bad about The Mosquito Coast. It's, man, I love that movie. But in general, I just think he is a special filmmaker, a smart, lyrical, hallucinatory filmmaker. He's a very dreamy filmmaker, and I don't think he gets his due.
You know, Master and Commander is one of my all-time favorite movies. Easily one of the best movies of the last 20 years. It's, it's a grand scale. There's a historical backdrop to it, but at the same time, there's such an intimacy in the relationships.
Which I think is not just a great film and one of the last great epics in the truest sense. I think is actually kind of a sliding doors change point moment in cinema history. I think 2003, when that comes along, and it is an old-fashioned, we don't make them like that anymore type film. I think if Master and Commander spawns a franchise at that point, the entire cinema landscape globally is completely different.
That's the movie that I wanted to see 10 of those, and yeah, I know they're big fans of Fast and Furious and everything, and God bless you, but Master and Commander should have been.
It's one of those things, again, I'm not a seafaring man, sir. But there is a sense of authenticity. There's a sense of really watching a genuine dedication to recreating history unfold on a big screen in front of you that can't help but inspire just genuine admiration and awe.
If you're going to pick a film where he really brings every one of his skills to the table, it's Master and Commander. I think you picked the right one, man.
Yeah, very excited to see what you pull out of this, Blake.
That's right. Our next series is Peter Weir and Russell Crowe's Master and Commander. The series is called Podcaster and Commander.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.